I'm going to talk about work. Oh, let me use this microphone. I'm going to be talking about work that has been over a long period of time since the late 90s. Doug and I had our first paper talking about stripes in the TJ model, I think in 97 or so. And we've kept returning to it because it's so essential or so crucial for the coup rates, which are one of the key problems. But there's been some progress and some increased interest recently. Part of it is, Giffrey and I are part of a Simons collaboration for the many electron problem that is trying to understand, do the different computational techniques for things like the Hubbard and TJ model. Do they agree? Is there some convergence in the results? And so we've been looking at some of this. Along with that, so one of the other key techniques is, there are tensor network methods, and the IPEPS method has been particularly impressive. So there's some nice recent results for that. So I'm going to show a little bit about a bit of that and talk about how that compares with the DMRG. And so it does look like we're progressing towards actually knowing what's going on in these models. And as we get closer to understanding the simple models, we realize where the simple models are not adequate. And so at the end of the talk, I'll show you some very recent results on the three-band Hubbard model. And there's a little bit closer to reality, and so we can see physics that's a little bit closer to the coup rates. But the key issue that comes up, the thing that we first saw as soon as we could do a DMRG calculation in two dimensions in the TJ model, was we saw stripes forming. We weren't looking for them. They appeared, and we said, what is this? And we then struggled to understand what they were. At the same time, and unfortunately a little bit ahead of us, the experiments were starting to see the first signs of stripes. So that's the sort of has emerged as the key issue. We know that the coup rates have a D-wave superconducting state. The various techniques all tend to show this D-wave superconducting state. A number of techniques don't show any signs of stripes, and DMRG does, and then the IPEPS also shows the stripes, although closely competing with other states. So that's the key issue. Okay, so just a quick slide on the technique. So we're using the DMRG method, which is adapted for a 1D system, just by switching the path that we take into two dimensions, so that we've mapped a finite width two-dimensional system onto effective 1D system with longer range interactions. And so DMRG is very efficient in one dimension. As soon as you make it into a finite width system, these long range terms make the accuracy fall off drastically, and we have to increase the computational effort. The key thing that we're controlling the effort with is what I call M, the matrix dimension. And so we can trade off and go to wider systems as long as we pay the numerical cost of making our matrices that are in the matrix product state bigger and bigger. And that's one of the things that has progressed over time, is that we can just have more efficient computation, that we can have larger M. I'll show a few results with PEPS, which is a much more natural representation of two dimensions, but it has the drawback that the computational efficiency is much worse than DMRG. And so one of the things I'll talk about is how the results between these two compare. Okay, so here's first a quick couple of slides for what you see as soon as you start simulating the TJ model. So these are both cylinders. So the systems I'll be showing you are almost always cylinders in the vertical direction, and then they're open on the left and right edges. And we don't use fully periodic because that's much less efficient for DMRG. These two particular systems are only different by a very slight amount, which is a pinning field that is on the edges here. And at one point, skeptics about the stripes in DMRG had thought that the pinning fields were driving everything. And so this was a comparison that was just designed to show that you got the same thing with and without the pinning fields. But that's just one minor issue. There's lots of issues that come up in looking at the results. And you have to sort of, you know, there's a lot of work that goes into trying to understand what the results mean. And so I'm going to be showing a number of movies, which the movies are always fun to see, but they also give you a lot of intuition for what the model wants to do. The movies are sort of mostly older results. They don't keep as many states as we can do now. They were a fair amount of work to do to process each slide, so I haven't updated them. But they still show the same things that we see with bigger calculations now. But we'll see sort of how these sorts of states emerge from the DMRG, and as it goes along, we'll see, you sort of get a sense of what the system is, what it cares about in terms of it lowering its energy to try to get a good ground state. Okay. Okay, and there's a few questions which I'll come back to. Okay, so here is a the first movie, and so what these movies are is it's gonna show the updating of the DMRG. So there's a path that goes through the system, and it's not gonna explicitly show the path, but you'll see a flickering that goes through the system that will tell you where the sweeping is. And so it's not in real time, it's not even imaginary time, it's just sort of DMRG time as we converge. And you'll be able to see the energy as we go along here. And then as we sweep, we slowly increase the matrix dimension, and the system slowly progresses towards the ground state. And eventually in all of these, we stop the calculation before it's exactly in the ground state. And so, you know, if we're pretty far from ground state, you can use your imagination to say, well, did it look like it was done evolving, or was it already there? But so this just has, this is sort of partway done with the first sweep when it's just sort of set up with a very small bond dimension, this sort of mean field-like antiferromagnetism. And then this was constructed with all eight holes in the system stuck right in the center. Okay. So we sort of see sort of right away this, so the coloring is showing whether the antiferromagnetism that's in the Z direction is sort of the A phase or the B phase. So if you sort of count across, like any two parallel near neighbor spins will be opposite colors. So what you're seeing in this, as we increase the accuracy of the calculation, that the system is sort of splitting up into these two stripes. And it's splitting up into these two stripes, but in the current, okay, you just saw this change color. This system at the beginning was set up with there's a domain wall in the antiferromagnetism across each stripe. And this was initially sort of randomly set up in the wrong way. And so the system sort of flipped this region of the system so that it could have these antiphase domain walls as it goes across the stripe. So this is a system that can usually find this, you know, this low energy configuration of the stripes. I'll show you results with much larger M eventually. So the system can often find the sort of true, the low energy ground state, but it can also get stuck. For instance, you could imagine if the stripes somehow started out going horizontally, they might have trouble finding the lower energy configuration that's vertical. The vertical configuration in these systems tends to be lower because it wraps around the cylinder, so the kinetic energy isn't like stuck in a particle in a box, it can just wrap around. Okay, so anyway, that's the first, yeah.
So here what you have is on the inside you have three options, either hole, spin up or spin down, that's your basis on spin.
Yes.
And that's what you're plotting here for each side.
Yes.
And the color tells you, the different blue and green tells you whether they are aligned antiferromagnetically or oppositely.
Right. So let me thanks for
there was a question after that.
Yes. So okay, great. But just to clarify this, the diameter of the hole is proportional to the expectation value of a hole being on that site. Not the area, but it shows up better if you do the diameter. And then, of course, the length of the arrows is expectation value of S sub z. And then the color coding is entirely automatic depending on whether an up arrow or a down arrow is on an even or odd site. Okay, now there was a question.
So how large can an arrow, how large should an arrow be before we think that that's in the problem space?
That I don't know the exact answer to that. You know, these arrows are around, you know, 0.35 or point, you know, something like that. Yeah. But it's far from a product state.
It's far from a product
state. Right.
So on one side, we could have a circle and an arrow, a big circle and a big arrow.
Something like this. Yeah. 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 And there's a lot going on there.
Right.
Yeah.
So yeah. How do those abandonments coding here?
The DMRG uses an SZ basis.
Right.
Okay, so it naturally, if you set it up, if you did it, just kept one state, the very beginning of a DMRG run, it would have to be lined up in the Z direction. Now, if it wants to do something else, it sort of has to do it, but take into account the fact that we quantize S sub Z, and so it can't just make a state that points out in some sort of random X direction or something. Say you had a system with non-collinear order, what, like in the triangular lattice. In the triangular lattice, what we would see with this type of calculation, that's 120 degree order. And in 120 degree orders, you might see one spin of the triangle being this, and then the other two would be half the size down. And you would think of it as being like a cone that is rotating the other direction that projects onto the z direction that we actually see. But in this sort of calculation, we can't measure S sub x. But we can also turn off that symmetry, and then we can see S sub x. So we sometimes do that for things like the triangular lattice. Okay, is designed. This has no holes in it at all. I'll show the movie, and what you're going to see is that it starts out with sort of a very strong antiferromagnetism, this sort of mean field state. I'm not showing any of the scales here, but they start out close to 0.5. And but this is a finite system with nothing to break the spin rotational symmetry. So the true ground state has expectation value 0 everywhere. And here you see it emerging at high accuracy in the calculation. So if you went back to where it was minus 38.05, you still saw quite substantial moments on every site. And so there's this last little bit of energy, in this case about 10 to the minus 4 relative energy, where it builds in the overall rotational symmetry. So you think of the antiferromagnet as having some direction at points, which is just a broken symmetry. But since it's a finite system, it can average over all possible directions. And that's a tiny little energy that we would see at the end of a calculation that was extremely well converged. Now, as soon as I start putting in holes into the system, we usually don't get that extreme accuracy. It's an even smaller part of the final energy. And so you'll see broken symmetry states. They'll, in terms of the spin, it'll just be locked up in the z direction. Okay, the other thing that can happen is that if you put the system specifically in some weird state, or if you just start it randomly sometimes, it may not find the ideal low energy state. So this is the same system that we saw earlier, which formed two stripes. And the low energy state was the stripes. And this was sort of set up so that the holes were in weird positions. And so it's sort of trying to make a stripe-like state, but it can't tunnel to the true ground state at all. So what you're seeing here is that it's possible for a pair of holes, there's two holes here, to be sort of stuck on the open edge. And so you're seeing a bit of that here. And then there's four holes in the center, and the four holes in the center are not able to sort of wrap around the system. That's tunneling that's too far. So they just sort of form a clump in the center, but you still see this anti-phase sort of region in the center. So the sort of lowest the sort of highest energy thing that it tries to do first is usually associated with trying to make the spins point opposite, put in the pi phase shift across any sort of region of holes. Okay, so we have to deal with this issue of we can be stuck in some funny situation. I think of this as being like a classical system where DMRG is doing the quantum part of the calculation in terms of local correlations. Okay, but then there's sort of a classical part of how do these things arrange themselves that DMRG, you know, is not a super solver that could solve a spin glass system with classical, you know, multiple minima. It just has to do sort of a crude tunneling between states, and so it can be stuck quite easily. Let me see if it. We can just go back. I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but you know, it's going to be something like 0.2, you know, out of this whole system, out of 40 or something, is probably the energy difference there. That's the sort of size. Okay. So here's a system. So we do these systems, and we manipulate the boundary conditions, and we try to make the boundary conditions let the system form the lowest energy state it can. If it has a single stripe through the system, you know, it should have an odd number of sites around because the single stripe is going to put in a pi phase shift. So if you don't pay attention to what the system is telling you and you just do a system, which you would probably put, you know, an even number of sites in each direction, you might be frustrating stripes. What our philosophy is to try lots of different boundary conditions and see what the system wants to tell us. So here's an experiment where we put open boundary conditions on all four sides, put the clump of holes in the center, and see what they try to do. Now, it immediately elongated in the y direction, but that's just because the path is sweeping in that direction, so it can move the particles very efficiently there. The equilibration is always faster in the y direction. Okay, but the other effect that we often seen is that if there's a stripe, it doesn't really want to end on an open edge because it's sort of like a particle in a box effect where the wave function gets set to zero on the edge, hopping kinetic energy. And so it tries to make the stripes not end on the edge. And so what this thing sort of does is it tries to curve around. And we've seen other ones where it makes a full sort of loop. In this case, it doesn't quite make a loop in this simulation. Maybe the number of holes is not quite the right amount, but it sort of makes this sort of curved stripe-like thing with the pi phase shift across the holes. And you know, it's a system where the boundaries have really frustrated the stripes trying to make the sort of arrangement that they might like to have. But the system just sort of goes in some direction to try to do this state. To try to get a low energy stripe-like configuration. Okay, this is a little calculation with just two holes, and it's got a T prime cranked out, which we learned, you know, makes the holes attract with a reasonably significant attraction. And so we start it with the two holes far apart. And you see that, so one of the things about this is that, you know, the holes in this model really have a high effective mass. They can't move very well without disrupting the antiferromagnetism. But right at the end, you saw these two holes find each other, and suddenly they form a pair in the center. And the pair is still looks, you know, somewhat localized here. And this is with cylindrical boundary conditions, so it should really delocalize around the whole system. But the pair still has this sort of big effective mass. And so the big effective mass means that sort of delocalizing is a fairly low energy process. And so we just haven't seen it yet in this calculation. Okay, so those are some movies that sort of give you a sense of how the calculation goes. And those were all, by today's standards, somewhat less accurate calculations. And so now we want to sort of take these and say, well, let's really try to understand how well converged we are. And so do we really know these states? So to play devil's advocate, you could just say, well, these are some low entanglement states that you found. But if you really crank the calculation longer, there could be some high entanglement states that it just didn't find. And that could be sort of a possibly a separate thing from just the stripes being stuck in one configuration versus the other. Okay, so we want to try to address that. One of the things that we have to sort of make sure that we have control in 2D DMRG is that we can make the cylinders narrower, where it really becomes almost exact diagonalization, and that's a very useful tool. It's like, well, I'm not sure if I've really got it. Crank the cylinder size down, and then it becomes very accurate. So these two are width 6, and the movies have been width 8. That makes a big difference. So here's two width 6 cylinders. Now, this is the low energy state. This is a system with 12 holes, and you should see 3 stripes there. And each stripe has 4 holes. One of the key properties of a stripe is what is the linear density of holes per unit length. And we know that in the cuprates, the ones where the stripes are most clear, they appear to have a density per unit length of 1/2. So 1 hole per 2 unit lengths. Now in the width 8 systems that I was showing in the movies, those stripes naturally came out at that correct density of 1/2 per unit length. In these, the width 6 system, if it had that density, it would be 3 holes in a line. And there's a strong tendency for these systems to pair. And so it doesn't want to have 3 holes. And so what the system will do is either do 2 holes or 4 holes. So we know from calculations on this that at least in the parameters where we study them the most, that the lowest energy region for the holes to be, the configuration is with a 4-hole stripe. So it's a little bit higher density than it might do in a wider system. Now, these two simulations were the same cluster and the same Hamiltonian, but they only differed by a different initial state. And the one on the left has, you could see it in the smaller m parts of the simulation, that there was a sort of a separate pair over here. And so there's 2 4-hole stripes, but the third stripe is split into 2 pairs on the opposite edges. Over here, we have the system. This is the lower energy configuration. It just makes the 3 stripes. So if you're over here, to get to this configuration, you have to take a pair here, make a very high density stripe, high energy, and then go through another one, and then get over here and then probably shift everything back to be centered. It's a long tunneling process. And so this is something that, you know, is that I wouldn't expect DMRG to ever be able to tunnel the pair all the way over there. In an exact diagonalization calculation, theoretically you should be able to get that tunneling, but you know, that sort of small tunneling rate could even be a problem for finite number of digits in your calculation. So here's the energy for these two calculations. The higher energy one on the left is here. And so the system just stays in these two metastable states and just stays there. But we get pretty good convergence, you know, for each state, but we can stay trapped in the wrong state. So this sort of problem we have to deal with by hand by doing lots of different simulations and finding out what the system wants to do to have low energy. So this makes this sort of, you know, hard to think of it as a black box sort of calculation. I think of this as being sort of a property of the TJ model itself. It's not so much that DMRG gets stuck as that the model acts like a classical system with different metastable states and so the system itself is getting stuck. Okay, so this is an example on, you know, cranking up the system size back up to 8, and we see these same stripe states. And this was something that we were seeing back in 98. And back then, we had an M up to about 2,000. So if I take systems like this with 8, now we can, last few weeks, I was doing runs with, you know, up to M equals 10,000 or 15,000. The first key thing is that it still looks like this, even when we cranked up M to be very large. You know, so that doesn't address metastability, but it at least says that it still looks like this in a calculation where you crank up the accuracy. And I'll show you. Yeah. 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 So you have to, first of all, the pieces of it have to fit properly. So we have anti-ferromagnetic regions. And so if you go to an odd number of legs, it won't fit. So then the system's going to try to do something else to accommodate that. I'm going to show a result where we actually do a sort of spiraling cylinder to try to turn one, you know, this would be four stripes. We can turn it into one very long stripe that spirals around. And that stripe is sort of forced by the boundary conditions. You know, it can't, you know, each boundary condition sort of forces, it allows some possible behavior and does not allow lots of other behavior. And that's always true for these finite system calculations. And so we can choose what we're allowing to happen and try to make it do something sensible. Right. Right. So the key issue is the competition between the exchange interaction of the spins and the holes kinetic energy of hopping, and it depends in particular on the sort of quantitative comparison of those. So the T is big, you know, T might be 3 times J, but there's a lot more spins than there are holes, and so somehow these are sort of they tend to be sort of balanced. And so if you have one hole that wants to hop around, as soon as it hops, it messes up the spins around it. So if they were parallel to each other with a hole in the middle, which would be the static hole configuration, and then you move the hole here, it makes two parallel spins. And so it doesn't want to do that, so it does something different. It tends to sort of make singlet bonds go across holes. And so we've tried to understand that in some detail, and we were trying to understand that, you know, in the very earliest work, so some of the stuff back in 96 or 97. And so that sort of picture of this competition between the hopping and the exchange, we still think is the way to understand it. So if you have a 1D system, that we understand how this works, you know, a 1D system, you have spin charge separation. And if you think of the holes as being vacancies, and you look at the spins sort of skipping over the holes, you'll see that the spins tend to line up sort of perfectly. And then the holes move around. And whenever a hole moves, it just makes a region of spins that's sort of happy. And so in a stripe system, you can think of it as some rows of 1D systems where the holes can hop back and forth. And they don't mess up the antiferromagnetism with their hopping, provided they have this pi phase shift across them. And so just lining them up, the region, they're allowed to sort of hop back and forth in a line and not mess up the antiferromagnetism too much. So it's all a question of where can they have some hopping and not mess up the antiferromagnetism. You already get some of that effect with just a pair, that the two holes can sort of heal each other's distorted spins. But they can seem to be able to do it a little bit better with the whole stripe configuration. Okay. Okay. Another question that people had early on about our results was with the open boundary conditions, which people were particularly not comfortable with in the before they were in the old days. They thought that the vertical stripes we were seeing might just be an oscillation, a Friedel type oscillation from a Fermi system up against an edge. And the way to show that isn't the case is to make the stripes go in the direction of the cylinder. And so the trouble is that they naturally want to wrap around the cylinder because that's lower kinetic energy going around, but we can tweak the system to get them to go this way. And that involves changing Jx and Jy by a fairly, say, 10% here. And by changing Jx and Jy, it manages to favor, there's this basic X versus Y asymmetry of the stripes favors the stripes running horizontally, and then we get some stripes that naturally form this way. Okay. The right-hand side is showing sort of the first results on the pairing response. Okay, so one way to see pairing response is to do pair correlations. But in DMRG, you get my screen is fine. It's there. Something not plugged in? Okay, it was just a twitchy plug. Okay, in DMRG calculations, you have bet.
I didn't touch it.
No, it's doing nothing. Hope that. Okay, so there's two ways to measure sort of the response of a system. One is through correlation functions, where you say, you know, measure S plus over here and far away, S minus over there. Or you can put on a field and then look at the response to that field. And the accuracy of DMRG turns out to be much better if you put on a field and look at the response. And we understand that. We understand the technical reasons for that, but it's a big effect. So we tend not to do correlation functions, we put on a field. So I want to see the response to I want to see the superconducting response. Well, the trouble with putting on a superconducting field is it breaks the number of particles. It makes the number of particles uncertain, modulo 2. And so we just do that. We sort of erase the quantum numbers that we normally keep that keeps track of the total number of quantum numbers and just keep track of the modulo 2. Then we can put on a pair creation and annihilation operator on these bonds and look at the response to the system. And then the dashed lines are one sign of the order parameter and the solid lines are the other. And so we're seeing a natural D wave response to the system. And it's progressing throughout the system. And so we would consider this to be a very nice, very big D-wave response, even though the magnitude is small. But you know, the pairing magnitudes are always small. You don't know how to create a pair. It's not like a simple spin where you know what you have.
Sorry, can you be a bit more detailed on this pairing? How do you use
it? Right. So the term that goes into the Hamiltonian. So we create a delta dagger operator, which is a C dagger operator on a two nearest neighbor bonds. And then we put in a term on the solid bonds here, where they're extra fat. We put in a term in the Hamiltonian that's delta plus delta dagger, so it's Hermitian. And we make it of order 1. We get a big response there. And then we just measure the same operator throughout the system, and everything else is sort of how the system responds.
So in this case, you put that operator in 4 places?
Yes. Okay, another feature of this is that these calculations, aside from the asymmetry, are around J over T of 0.5. And we found that the results for pairing are reasonably sensitive to the value of J over T. So a bigger value of around 0.5 gives much stronger pairing. Around 0.3, it's quite a bit weaker. Okay, this is a few more details of that set of calculations with that geometry. If we have the number of particles uncertain, then we have to control the number of particles with a chemical potential. So we vary the chemical potential, and we see these different results. And we're seeing results here for both the pairing response and, let's see, what is up here? Doping equals delta equals one. And I forget what. Delta equals one. I think this is just the scale of the size of the term I put on it, but I'm not sure why this looks different. Okay, sorry. Over here, we have the size of the pairing response, and we look at it as a function of doping. So this is a system that always has those two stripes in them, and so it's really not allowed to change the nature of the state very much. It can't change the distance between the stripes. But within that sort of constrained state, we see this sort of behavior as a function of doping, you know, which looks sort of like what you see in the cuprates. And the interesting thing is that there's a particular suppression of the pairing response at a doping of 0.125, which happens to be also seen in some of the cuprates. So we can look to see what happens at that particular system. Okay, and so here's the system at 0.125. And the key thing that seems to suppress the pairing, so here, first of all, here's the pairing response for this system. So this is a system that doesn't want to pair. We put on the fields there, and in the center of the system, we just get a very weak response. And what seems to be driving that is a charge density wave, a commensurate charge density wave along the stripe. Okay, so there's a couple of things that could be going on in the real system. You know, you could have sort of a commensurate locking that corresponds to the spacing between stripes of being four. And that occurs right at this particular doping of 1/8. But what seems to be happening here is that all of the systems were locked with that spacing, a commensurate spacing, but this was something that happened along the stripe. Okay, so that's sort of interesting, but we're not, you know, we really can't, we only sort of have this system to do this on. We don't have a range of systems to sort of try to understand this more clearly. Okay, so this is some recent work where we're trying to benchmark the accuracy of the calculations in order to compare with different methods. And in particular, there's a paper I'll show you results from by Philippe Corbeau as the first author with IPEPS results. There's a couple of papers. And it shows some nice results showing comparisons between uniform states and stripe states. Okay, so the question is, how do you compare those? And one thing you do is you look at the total energy of the calculation and see how accurate it is. Now, this is a particular system that I like it for understanding stripes. It's wrapped with a shift of four when you connect periodically. So the arrows are actually connected, the red arrows. And so it sort of forces the stripes to connect onto each other if you put in the doping where they want to have stripes at this distance. And so this really looks like one long stripe throughout the whole system. Now, in the other cylinders, you know, most of the other cylinders with width 8, they were really four whole stripes, and they were sort of locked up at four holes. They couldn't fluctuate to 2 or 6, which is a key ingredient of pairing. And so this way, they can fluctuate a lot more because it's just one long stripe, which sort of has both 1D and 2D character to it. Okay, so this is sort of I think this is a nice system to study with the MRG. And so we did some fairly big calculations with this, going up to m equals 8,000. And one of the things that we do in DMRG is do extrapolations of the total energy versus the truncation error. And these tend to just require linear extrapolations. They tend to behave rather nicely, as you can see here. And so we can extrapolate. So we have an energy for this system that's the variational energy, the m equals 8,000. And then we have the extrapolation. And the extrapolation, we tend to just sort of arbitrarily choose 1/5 of the last extrapolation as the error bar. And that seems to be a pretty good amount over lots of different systems. But this sort of behavior is fairly typical, and so we do this quite a bit. So I can quote two different results, the variational result and the extrapolated result. Now, for the energy for this system, a nice thing to compare with different systems is the energy per hole in the system, where you subtract off the antiferromagnetic background. And in doing that, you have to make sure the antiferromagnetic background is not frustrated, and it has the same number of bonds. And so here, that was a little bit more. You had to be careful in subtracting off. So this is actually subtracting off a thing with only a shift of 3, so that it didn't actually frustrate the antiferromagnetism. Okay, and so the result for this gives us a benchmark of -1.62 or so energy per hole for this system, which has a J over T of 0.4. And so that compares pretty closely with the IPEPS results. And then the variational result was this -1.577. Okay, so here's Philippe Corbeau's plot from the most recent paper. And it shows, and then I've added some extra dashed lines onto the plot, which is just the results from the previous slide, plus one other. Okay, so what? So Philippe is doing IPEPS with a particular unit cell, and the choice of unit cell is sort of a mild bias of the system towards a particular sort of broken symmetry. And so if he uses a small unit cell, the system sort of naturally becomes uniform. And if he allows it to be a little bit longer, it can form stripes that are either diagonal or horizontal and vertical. So the W5 are the horizontal and vertical stripes. This is like what the DMRG results I've been showing. The U is the uniform state, and then there's some diagonal stripes, which I haven't been showing. Okay, and then also shown here, so this is all in this energy per hole, so we can try to compare different calculations. Here are results from the fixed node Monte Carlo plus 2 Lanczos steps that Becca and Sorella have been using for a while. Okay, and then we can say, well, who has the lowest energy? This is the lowest energy here, but if you back up and say, well, this has finite size effects. So the IPEPS is infinite, no finite size effects whatsoever. The quantum Monte Carlo is fairly big. The DMRG is more constrained by having a finite cylinder. And you see that if you back up this finite width cylinder 2 steps to get the 32/5 instead of 32/7, you have an energy up here. So that's a sort of estimate, some sort of estimate of sort of finite size effects. And so the finite size, so when you're comparing these results, you sort of have a trade-off. You can trade off finite size effects. In DMRG, if you allow the finite size effects to be bigger, use smaller cylinders, you can always get very high accuracy. If you make it bigger, then other methods will have lower energy. And then these results, the IPEPS results, are all variational. So the variational DMRG result is right here and right neck and neck with them. So extremely close comparison. So I would say that right now IPEPS, for the TJ model, IPEPS and DMRG are sort of tied at width 8 cylinders or width 7 cylinders. And then depending on which way you go, you get one more accurate than the other. One of the nice things about the DMRG is that this extrapolation is understood so well, it works so well, we can have some confidence in that, whereas extrapolating in D here is not understood very well. Okay, but the big sort of surprise of this result is how close in energy the uniform state is with the stripe state. You know, why should they come out so close in energy? So the thing is that the uniform state is dropping faster, and the stripe state starts lower, but you know it's not dropping as fast, and so we really can't say which one is winning. The DMRG gives a little bit more bias towards the stripe state, but But a key question is, why does the system have such a close tie? And so the first thing you might say is that, well, we just happen to land on a phase boundary between two different states that happen to come out to be nearly identical. Okay, but then what Philippe did was he varied the value of J over T, and he found that this tie persisted. And he didn't show it in terms of energy, but he showed it in terms of the pairing response. So up here we have, so W5 is the stripe state. So here we're varying J over T over a broad range, and we're looking at the maximum pairing response of the system. So these stripe states had pairing in them, and we're seeing this behavior that is coming out very close, and it's having the same trend. Okay, so this is the big puzzle of the recent results. What I think is probably going on is that these two states are, in some sense, very close to being the same, that they have local correlations that are essentially very close. There's this competition between the antiferromagnetism and the hopping that's making sort of, you know, you think of it at high temperature, there's some sort of liquidy state that has a lot of the low energy correlations built in. And then as you go at lower temperature with slightly different biases or different Hamiltonians, you can split off and maybe you break a symmetry that favors stripes, or maybe you, you know, don't break it and you get something else. And so I think that the key is that you should really think of these as being almost the same state. But the key question is, can we get some evidence for that? And we don't have any evidence for that so far. But you can think of a stripe as being a modulated D-wave state, just sort of alter the densities a little bit, alter the antiferromagnetism, but it's sort of underlying in the short-range behavior. Or you can think of the uniform D-wave state as a fluctuating stripe. And so they don't have to be so far apart. The other thing that I should mention is that as D gets large in the IPEPs, these curves have, you know, we really expect these curves to always come together because the effect of the unit cell should vanish in the limit that the accuracy of the calculation becomes. They should all get the ground state. So it shouldn't be a surprise that these should come together. It's just a surprise that they're coming together sort of at still pretty small D. Yeah.
So by the same reasoning, you would expect that as you increase the one dimension, as you move to the left, the difference between the states, between the stack state and the uniform state, would start to disappear.
Well, you may have to do some averaging over the system with the broken symmetry. So what I think is that if you look at the local density matrix and you average the system with the broken symmetry over different positions, then those local density matrices should become very similar. And so I don't think Philippe has done that calculation, except that he's looked at the pairing response, which is showing a very similar behavior. So I'd like to see a calculation done, and I don't think anybody's done it. I'd like to see a calculation where we look at a local density matrix for these different systems and just see how close they are and whether they're coming together, see if the states are really that different. Yeah. We have not found any. We've looked for, so for instance, if you had two stripes and you say perhaps the phase of the pairing changes sign between the stripes, that would certainly agree with interpretations of some of the experiments. We've looked for that and we see a small energy difference that always favors the uniform state, but the energy difference is very small. That's as much as we know. So far, we haven't seen any real modulations in any parameter regime that show up as something real. Okay, so I have much fewer results for Hubbard models, and the main reason is that the Hubbard models have more degrees of freedom, more local entanglement, and so they're just harder for us to do. The biggest effect is just that the local dimension is 4 instead of 3, the number of states per site. But there's also, you know, the antiferromagnetism comes about through charge fluctuations in the Hubbard model, and it's sort of just put into the model in the TJ model. So it's a fairly big difference. in the accuracy, but we're getting better and better at this. So this is cranking it up to M equals 15,000, and we're only doing a width 6 system. And you see the same sort of stripe pattern, and this is for U over T equals 8, that we saw in the TJ model. So far, all of our results are consistent that if you have large U over T, you get sort of essentially TJ-like results in the Hubbard model. Now, these stripes seem a little bit smeared out more than in the TJ model, and that also seems like a difference, a real difference between the systems, that there's a tendency to, that the sort of stripe formation isn't as sharp in the Hubbard model, but it's still there. But if we look at smaller values of U, so at smaller values of U, the system looks more like a free fermion system, which is notoriously hard for tensor networks, has the log multiplicative factor in the entropy. So we move U down and it gets harder, but it's not enormously harder. But another effect that we see is that the finite size effects get bigger. And so these are harder, but we only have a few results. But the main thing that you see here is sort of qualitatively, it shows some of the features of the stripe, but not in a very not in a very organized way. Not, here you see the hole density is high, and that's where the pi phase shift and the antiferromagnetism. This has some modulation of the antiferromagnetism, but it doesn't line up very well with the hole density variation. And so it looks like a state that's not totally different from stripes, but it's not a sort of much of a real stripe. So we think of this as that there's a sort of small U physics or weak coupling physics in the Hubbard model and strong coupling physics in the Hubbard model. Maybe that change between the two different regimes is centered around U over T of about 6. But it doesn't look like there's a sharp difference in the properties as a function of U. And in fact, you get D-wave pairing both at weak coupling and at strong coupling in the Hubbard model. As far as we know for the strong coupling, it's pretty clear at weak coupling. So it's not like you have to have a certain value of U to get the D-wave pairing. It's sort of there throughout the regime. Okay. Now, I just showed a result, maybe one movie, with a T prime turned on that made the pairs bind together. You find interesting behavior when you study T prime. T prime has a big effect on the occurrence of stripes. And it depends on the sign of T prime. But let's just look at this data as for positive T prime. So T prime is the root 2 hopping. And this we're back to the TJ model. OK, so here we have T prime fairly small, 0.1. We still see stripes. We crank it up, and the stripes essentially disappear. And we get a uniform. The antiferromagnetism is uniform. The hole density is very uniform. And if you look at how, and we saw that movie where at positive T prime, the holes bound together. So we think of this as a nice sort of pair superconductor. And if you look at pairing correlations, which are shown here, as you crank up the T prime, the pairing correlations are much bigger. Here they're essentially tied at T prime equals 0.2 and 0.3. Here they look extremely small, but this is an effect of locking up exactly 4 holes in a stripe, and it's not being able to fluctuate between stripe to stripe. Okay, so it seems like we can understand the behavior of T prime, that positive T prime will weaken stripes and it'll enhance pairing. If you make T prime negative, and I won't show this, but if you make T prime negative, it also tends to break up the stripes, but it suppresses pairing. And we think we understand that even from the point of view, you can see the same sort of effect if you just do a hand diagonalization of a 2x2 plaquette with T primes on it. You can see the same sort of behavior. So it seems like a very simple behavior of what does T prime do. The trouble is that if we go to the coup rates and say where is T prime positive and where is it negative, T prime greater than zero is thought to correspond to the electron doped cuprates, but they have a weaker superconducting response. T prime less than zero is supposed to correspond to whole dopes. So this seems to be completely backwards compared to, the simulations seem to be completely backwards compared to the behavior of the cuprates. And so this has been a puzzle for a while. Okay, so one way of dealing with that puzzle is to go to a more realistic model. And so this is work that we've just been, Doug and I have been working on this summer. And we're going back to a three-band model that puts in one orbital on each copper and one orbital on each oxygen. And here are the parameters. So we have the T's are all hoppings, the V's are density-density interactions, the U's are on-site density interactions, and the epsilons, I just show one of them here, but that's an on-site energy that couples to the density on each site. Okay, and then this is the parameters for this have been calculated with density functional theory, with realistic materials, but we don't know really how good those are, but they seem to have held up for a while. And so here are the sort of standard set of parameters, and all we did from the standard one is just express it all in units of the shortest hopping, and then round the numbers a little bit. And so it's sort of a basic standard model with not adjusting anything. And then the question is, well, what do we get from the simulations? And so the simulations are not as big as what I've been showing you in terms of coppers. You know, the number of coppers is only 4 around, but that seems to be enough to show a lot of the sort of tendencies to form stripes or not in this system. And then it turns out that these calculations are really not so difficult. We'll be able to crank up probably to width 6. These are just sort of, not even overnight calculations. And the reason that it's easier than people would have thought is that it all depends on the entanglement between the two sides of the system. And the number of bonds that you cut, even though there's more sites in the system, is still only 4 for a 8x4 copper system. Okay, so the presence of the oxygens doesn't really raise the entanglement. It just gives you a factor of 3 more atoms to iterate over, but it seems to be just a factor of 3. Yeah?
What's happening with the oxygens? You don't have the same level.
Okay, so this one is the undoped system, and so this is a whole model. And so the undoped system has, on average, 1 hole per copper. And that hole most likely sits on the copper. And so the occupancies here are around 0.8 and 0.1 and 0.1 for where that hole is. And then the antiferromagnetism shows up in the coppers, and each oxygen is between 2 ordered copper. Each oxygen is between 2 ordered coppers, and so it has a negligible moment anyway. But mostly the spins are on the coppers anyway. Okay, so this is a very sensible result to understand the undoped cuprates. It looks like what we should expect, and that's sort of telling us that these parameters are fairly sensible. Then we turn on the doping. So this was 32 particles, 32 holes, and so here, the electron dope, this is only 28 holes, and this is 36. And so it pushes us over into the doping that you would say is plus or minus 1/8. And what we see is, to see the effect of the extra doping, we subtract off the densities over here, but not the spins, just the densities. And we see where the extra holes are going. Okay, so over here we have the whole dope system. The extra holes are going on the oxygens with I think it's like 70% onto the oxygens, a weak effect onto the coppers. And that's what we expect. And it has to do with the energy cost for putting something on the oxygens versus doubly occupying the coppers. But the key result here is that we're seeing what looks like a stripe, as much as this small system can make a stripe. So if you look at the antiferromagnetism, let's see, the colors don't work in the arrows here, but if you say this one is down, that should be up, that should be down, and that should be up. But instead, this one is down. So there's been a pi phase shift across here, and the density on the oxygens is higher there. And then there's another pi phase shift over here, and a higher density. Okay, so this is suggesting that the hole-doped systems have a bigger tendency to form stripes. Over here, we have the electron-doped systems. And you can't see the arrows as well, but you can come look up closer if you want. But there's no pi phase shifts along here. The modulation in the density is much smaller. It looks a little bit sort of more random. So it really doesn't show any sign of stripes in the electron doped system. Okay, and how does that compare with experiments? Here's experiments for the cuprates, the general phase diagram. I'm not showing anything about pairing because we don't have anything for pairing on this yet. But the main thing here is that this antiferromagnetic region, there's a big commensurate antiferromagnetic region on the electron doped side. And so over here, this antiferromagnetism without any pi phase shifts is very consistent with this. We're sitting at 0.125. On the hole doped side, we have the antiferromagnetism going away almost immediately. And so I interpret that as being that the stripe formation sort of cuts the antiferromagnetic regions into pieces and sort of destroys the overall order sort of very effectively, even at very small hole doping. Okay, and then here are various dopings showing essentially the same sort of behavior. The number of particles, either electrons or holes, is shown along here. And so here's the two stripes that we saw. Here's sort of one sort of broad stripe, three stripes. The pi phase shifts are appearing. And none of that occurs over in the electron dope side. Always has commensurate antiferromagnetism and sort of more uniform hole doping. Okay. Finally, we tried to understand what causes this asymmetry between the electron-doped and the hole-doped side, at least from the point of view of the models. And so we looked at a few parameters varying, and we quickly zeroed in on TPP, the hopping between two oxygens. And so what it turns out that if you set TP equal to zero, you induce a stripe state in the electron-doped side. Okay, so we think that TPP should be about 0.5 in these units. You turn it off, and you go back to this sort of stripe state. So it looks like the TPP is having a big effect, but only on the electron dope side. On the hole dope side, the TPP still leaves a state that looks very similar. It has stripes. And if you think about how the system really connects up with a single band model and the effect of T prime, I think in some ways this makes sense. So if we think about the electron doped system, what the TPP does, say we had a hole here, we have a hopping that can come here. If we have a TP, another hopping there, and then a third hopping there, would give us a T prime between the coppers. And that process really only makes sense on the electron doped side. So it looks like the TPP is modulating the T prime, and that is what is driving, at least from the single particle, single band point of view, that's what's driving the difference between the two regions. But then that argument in the hole doped side is much harder to make because you have this more complicated Zhang-Rice singlet that takes the mapping from three bands to one band on the hole doped side. And it's not clear how this TPP fits into that. Okay, so we still need to understand that. Okay, so in conclusion, we can use DMRG to study cylinders, and the system sizes are, say, moderate, but we can get good accuracy, and we can use this to address many of the properties of the TJ and Hubbard models. And it looks like a lot of those properties are sort of starting to fit together with different methods and making some sense. The key issue has been the presence of stripes and how are they related to superconductivity. Some of the results show that you can have both pairing and stripes at the same time, so they don't have to strictly compete. In particular, if you vary the J over T in the TJ model, you see very robust superconducting stripes. The Hubbard model has at large U over T similar physics to the TJ model. And then if you look at the copper-oxygen model, at least the electron hole asymmetry effects seem to show up very naturally in a model without even playing with any of the parameters. Thanks.
Charge density running along the stripe.
Oh, yeah.
And so does that have the same period for the modulation as along as the stripe modulation? Or is it, so if we did a scattering experiment, we have different cues for the modulation parallel perpendicular.
So if this is, this should, in this direction, you have a sort of spacing. A periodic spacing of 4, and if you can try to look at this and say, well, here's the start of this sort of bump, and you go over 4, and it looks sort of like the start of the other bump, but it's not quite perfect, but it looks like it should be about the same, and it should be the same if it really locks it up at 1/8. You might think that sort of, you think of each little bump as being a pair, and then the spacing should be 4 in both directions in order for it to work out to occur at exactly 1/8 doping.
So is this like, this looks like a checkerboard in charge then and a stripe in spin? Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Okay. Can you infer anything about the trends of the periods of stripes and function of doping? Or is that very difficult?
Well, Philippe has a much better, with the IPEPS, has a much better handle on that. Just by the nature of the calculation. So we, we're trying to find clever cylinders that let us address a particular question, but we can't just do an arbitrary doping, things have to fit. So we could look at the behavior of a single stripe and look at where the sort of minimum in energy per hole came. And we had found, back in the late 90s, that was coming in at 1/2 hole per unit length. So we were seeing a sort of broad minimum. Philippe's latest results are saying that, that's sort of looking at one stripe, but if you look at sort of the whole state, it looks like you can get a doping along of the stripe that varies with J over T. So it's not some magical value of 1/2. That just happens to be the minimum at, say, J of 0.35 or 0.4.
So in the conclusion, you mentioned that the key issue is the relationship between stats and pairing. But I think this was one of the only slides where you talked about pairing. Is there anything that comes out of these simulations, any intuition of what the relationship may be between these two?
If you look at where the holes are, you see sort of within a stripe, you sort of see it sort of well-defined pairs. You make a measurement that sort of just looks for the holes, as you can look for all, sort of sample and find where the typical distribution of all the holes are. So you tend to see that the stripes tend to have pair structure within them. And so you have pair formation, and then the question for getting superconductivity is do you get the phase to give you superconductivity over the whole system? And that can compete with charge density waves like we had here. And then there's the issue of if you just have a stripe, if the holes are really locked onto the stripe, they may have you know, you might think of them more as Josephson tunneling to the next stripe. Whereas if the stripes are really fuzzy, they just, you know, it's a slight dip and they walk across. And so those are the issues. That's the way we've tried to understand it. In the end, we end up just having to do the simulations to see how strong the response is. The complication with that is that, you know, all the responses are weak because it's just sort of the nature of pairing and the operators that we use.
So do you have this is the only probe you have to for pairing? You just look at how the system reacts.
Well, we do correlations also. You know, we've looked at
so you can measure correlations, and depending on the results, you conclude that this ground state supports
right
certain type of superconductivity.
Right.
But that's the only probe that you have.
I think so.
What about stiffness?
Superfluid stiffness?
Yeah.
Yeah, we can do that. The energies are very small, and so we can maybe resolve that. We've tried that a little bit in the past. I don't know if anything made it to the publishing stage. But you know, certainly we can try that. And certainly we do try that. But the energies are pretty small.
One more quick question. If not, let's thank Steve again.